I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Craft. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
So I swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great, yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages. The arts are widely recognised as a unique tool for human expression and offer a valuable contribution to society. They define our humanity. For anyone working in the arts, it is a wonderful and fulfilling profession. But a creative or performance career will present considerable emotional challenge. Navigating an industry with precarious employment opportunities means that artists, on and off the stage, may experience mental health concerns, anxiety, or stress. Sophie Carter is a qualified counsellor and coach who supports those who work within all sectors of the arts. She discovered a passion for music and performing at a young age. Finding a calling in theatre as a teenager, she never looked back and went on to enjoy a nearly 20-year career as a professional actor, singer and dancer. Sophie has also had roles behind the scenes as a stage manager, an assistant director, an assistant producer and a vocal coach. She continues to perform regularly in the contemporary live music scene and has ridden the turmoil of the COVID and post-COVID era alongside her fellow performers in an ever-shifting landscape. With 2 decades experience working in the professional theatre, music and film TV industries, Sophie brings her lived experience with the arts to the counselling experience to help her clients navigate this wonderful but challenging industry.
Now, I really meant it when I said on the phone to, I can talk and I can go on a tangent and to have, I have no problem with you reeling me in because I will talk. How long is the podcast?
About an hour.
Okay, that's good.
You'll have no.
Have no issues.
I mean, since you walked in the door, you know, there's been no issue.
Look, I can be a chatty Cathy, that's for sure.
But that's great. That's a good skill to have.
good.
Sophie Carter, you've been in the a performer now for a couple of decades.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, when you put it like that. It is true, but
it creeps
gosh.
Up, doesn't it? All of a sudden, oh, my God, I've been doing it for 20 years.
I know. And to be honest, it started as a hobby, and I still have moments of like, wait, I'm still doing this? How is this? How did I get so lucky that I'm still doing this after all this long? Because it was just a hobby that just snowballed.
But it's a vocation which is quite tough. It presents its challenges, isn't
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah. You know, yeah.
They say it's a wonderful profession, but a really tough industry.
I say it's the best and the worst all rolled into one. I don't think there's many things that you can say, you know, have that duality, but yeah, it is absolutely the best. The highest of the highs and, yes, the lowest of the lows at the same time. But you wouldn't want to do anything else.
No, absolutely. No. I mean, when you have those highs, there's nothing like it, is there?
No.
I mean, you know, that they say applause is like a drug. There's nothing like that. I think affirmation at the end of the night.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think it's the applause, but I think it's... I know for me also it's just that feeling, that personal feeling you get in that moment. You know, that sort of, I don't want to say transcendent, but I guess that feeling where you sort of leave your body a little bit, you know, they don't happen all the time. And if you're doing a show for 2 years or 2.5 years, you know, those moments probably get fewer, but those moments where you sort of do, it is just about you and the material, you know? So, you know, for me, it's about those moments as well as the audience. The audience does help, of course.
Of course. So did you want to be a performer all your life? You know, as a kid, did you do it?
No, do you know what? It's really funny. I think back to an exercise that I had to do in like year one, where we drew a picture of what we wanted to do or what we wanted to be when we grew up. And I remember I had two ideas. I wanted to be either a secretary or an airline stewardess. And then ended up as a singer. And I find it funny sometimes because I sort of think how many kids probably did the reverse. You know, not that there's anything wrong with becoming a secretary or, when you grow up, but you know, the amount of six-year-olds that would have said, oh, I want to be a singer when I grow up, I want to be on stage or a performer, and then they end up in a more traditional job, and this was the complete opposite. Be like, how great would it be to be a secretary? That would be fun.
Well, that just reminded me of a similar class exercise we did I must have been about six, in year one or prep, and I drew a picture of a clown in a circus. I mean, because
you're probably not far off.
Not far off. No, very similar. But I'm thinking back to that, and it's probably because the only entertainment we had in the little country town that I grew up in was the annual visit of the circus.
Oh,
so that's what I saw as performance, as acting, and then of course later on you discover the MGM musicals, which appear every Sunday.
Yes,
on the telly.
Yes. I also grew up with a lot of that, and Bill Collins on a Saturday night, all of that. Yep. Thanks to my brother.
Was he a bit of a fan?
Oh, yeah. So my brother Nathan Carter, who's also a performer in music theatre, he grew up on Golden Years of Hollywood movies through my grandmother, I think. And he's 6 years older than me. So by the time I came along and, you know, was a few years older, he then started introducing them to me. So, no, we grew up on a lot of those, like 42nd Street and...
Showboat.
And yeah, Oklahoma. Gold Diggers of 1933 you know, all those movies that I'm curious how many people know of these days. Kiss Me, Kate, you know, with a young Bob Fosse in there. And a lot of really obscure ones as well. We really grew up on that. And, you know, getting back to your question before about wanting to be a performer, it's funny, you know, that we both ended up becoming performers because when we were kids, and I'm talking like, you know, he would have been like, I don't know, 12 and I would have been 6, and we would reenact like big production numbers from these movies in our lounge room. We had the typical Gen X upbringing, so we were basically left to our own devices all the time. And it was basically he and I and our Betamax, you know, VCR.
So it wasn't even VHS?
Oh, no. So, no, we eventually got to VHS. Right. We weren't that behind, but we did start with our beta tapes. Mm. And, yeah, we would watch these movies and we would reenact them with props and, like, we did the full thing.
So your first teachers were Ann Miller and Catherine
Absolutely.
Grace.
Yes. Kiss Me, Kate. I love Kiss Me, Kate.
Yeah,
it's a great movie. But we would reenact this stuff and then we would swap roles and do it again, you know, just for fairness and equality.
So you got to do the boys' roles and Nathan got to do the girls'
sometimes, roles. Absolutely. So we grew up with that. And then by the time I became a teenager, I discovered there was a local youth music theatre group that worked out of Glen Street Theatre up in Belrose. That was when Glen Street Theatre was sort of a community theatre. It's probably not as much anymore, but local amateur theatre companies, community theatre groups could put on shows there. And there was a group that worked, the teacher that ran it worked out of Forest High School, which was sort of near where I lived. And we would, by the time I got to high school, we would go and see these musicals for school excursions. And then I was working in McDonald's in Brookvale at this point, and one of the leads, one of the girls that would always play one of the leads, came through drive-thru one night, and I was standing there waiting at the window, waiting for the food to arrive to give to her, and I had to like make conversation, and I was like, oh my God, it's that girl that does those shows. And because I had to just stand there and wait, I finally worked up enough courage. I was like, oh, you do those shows? And she's like, oh, yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, I'd like to do one of those. That looks like fun. And she's like, oh, we're auditioning for our next production of Grease, you should come and audition. And I did. And then that was sort of it. I think I was like 15 or 16. And it was like finding your people. It was like finding your tribe.
What was the name of that youth theatre company?
Forest Youth Theatre Company.
Yeah, because I've spoken to Ditch Davey.
Yes, yeah, so Ditch.
Justin Smith.
Yes, Justin. I had a huge crush on Justin. I'm not sure if Justin is aware of that.
He knows now.
He does know now. Stephen May. There's a few people that actually went through Forest Youth Theatre Company. Yeah, that it, and it's, I mean, I look back on it now and I've seen the adults that ran that. I actually came and saw one of the band gigs that I do. It was really lovely. It was this full circle moment. They came to see me do this thing. And I said, you know, no word of a lie. It's like, I'm not sure if we'd be having this conversation right now, if you would have come to see this show, if I'd be doing this at all, if I'd have not had that experience as a teenager. And back then it was about having fun. It wasn't about, I don't remember there being a lot of competition. It was finding like-minded young people of the same age. And it was such a social thing. Like, we had fun on stage and everything, but it was about rehearsal. It was about the after parties. It was about sort of the whole process. It's sort of like almost the show was down the list on why you did it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, finding that community, finding those like-minded people and just having that fun around it. And so, you know, so for my first few shows, they were amateur, but it was really having that experience and that camaraderie that only that little ecosystem can give you.
Mm.
And unless you have, if you've done a show, you'll understand it. But if you haven't done a show, I think sometimes, or worked in a creative capacity with like-minded people, it's a very hard thing to explain to people of just how intimate that is.
Yeah.
Like, you're a family for those weeks, months, however long it goes for. It's very intimate and it's very special. And it's addictive.
I did a lot of community theatre too, and it was about fun. You take on any role, any size role,
mm-hmm.
and do it. No drama whatsoever.
No.
It probably wasn't until I got to drama school and training that all of those anxieties that come with being a performer
mm-hmm.
start to set in, because there's a sense of competition, there's a sense of being continually judged by your teachers, by your peers.
You start to
self-doubt and really
mm-hmm.
really fall apart if you let it.
It's I mean, drama school I mean, I also went to drama school. We both went to Whopper at different times. That is certainly a very unique experience. And it's, you know, when I went to Whopper, it was the right time to go, because I had done with Forest Youth, I'd done, I think I did like 7 shows with them. And I'd also been training with Joy Yates, who's a jazz singer based up in Newport, because for a time there, I wanted to be a jazz singer. But then I realized, like, oh, no one pays attention to you when you're singing jazz. You just end up being this sort of like wonderful, beautiful sort of backgroundy thing. And it's not like music theatre where they sort of pay a ticket to sit and watch and have a full experience with you and everyone on stage. So I went through a bit of a jazz experience. But I think I'd reached a point where it's like everything I had was experience, but not so much the refining of skills. So I sort of needed to put the experience side of it up on a shelf and just get back to sort of the education side of it, really. So it was the perfect time to go. But you'd land, especially when you go to somewhere like Whopper, it's very isolated. It's, especially when you come from Sydney and you're 20, how old was I? 23, I think, when I went. It's sort of like, oh, all the pubs are closing at 9 and the shops aren't open on Sunday. And this is a very different experience. So it is a very, it can be a very stressful, like talking microcosms,
yeah.
ecosystems.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably one of the most intense ones you can get, because again, you're with your people, but like you say, there is this element now of, oh, what are they good at? And what are they good at? And what am I good at? And so where does that leave me? And so that comparison thing starts seeping in a little bit, which I think is understandable. And I think it's valuable because it's really good to have an idea of who you are within the whole system. But if you're a young person at the same time, that where you're going to feel that anxiety up against other people, the two things, if you don't have a good hold on it, it can play tricks.
Do they still have Song Rep when you were there?
Yes.
That weekly concert where you performed one of the songs that you've been learning in a class all week. I detested those days.
Oh.
I mean, that was just, you know, you're up there thinking, oh my God, they're all sitting there watching, thinking, I could do that better than you.
Oh, absolutely.
Look, I reflected later why we had something like Song Rep. I guess it's to sort of toughen the nerves, give you nerves of steel.
Yeah.
Because when you're out there in the industry, you're facing audition panels all the time.
Absolutely.
These people who are sitting on the other side of a table judging you.
Yeah. And I think it's like the word judgment, I think it has a couple of different meanings. And I think we have to be honest that in auditions, the judgment comes purely from a technical perspective, as in like, what do they look like? What do they sound like? Yeah, what can they do? Because we have to fit a certain thing. Do they fit it or not?
You're in the room because you're talented.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So it's not so much like, dance for me, monkey, you know, sing for me, rummy. It's not sort of like this challenging thing, because obviously they want you to be the person. They want you to be good. They want you to be the person that they've been looking for the whole time, which I think is something we forget. So, you know, I think it's good to have that perspective that judgment doesn't necessarily mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Yeah. But I hear what you're saying, especially about Song Rep, because, yeah, that judgment is coming from your peers in that sense. And like you, I can understand why we did a class like that. For me, you know, I went to WAPA with, you know, like every year, everyone had their own set of skills. Everyone would have played a different role in something. You know, we were all there because we were good at what we did, but we all represented a different type of show or a different type of character and all that sort of stuff. So Song Rep was a great leveler in that sense, because it's like I was and still am a belter. The beautiful, pretty soprano thing, that ain't me at all. I was and will always be the brassy, loud one. And so one week I'm going to be singing something sweet and beautiful and feeling completely out of my depth and performing it in front of the girls who can do that on their ear. But the following week, we're going to pull out some Merman and then we're going to sort of see where everyone sits, you know, with that. Right. So you would have your good weeks, but then you would sort of have your challenging weeks as well.
Yeah. Look at it's me. Tough. Look at my Mama Rose, bitches.
Actually, I'm not sure if we did any Merman looking back, but yeah, all of that big brassy stuff I would feel comfortable with. But, you know, getting out of your comfort zone is a good thing. And if anything, drama school is going to force you into that place, whether you like it or not, of being completely out of your comfort zone. And that's, in hindsight, probably hated at the time, but in hindsight, that's not necessarily a bad thing, you know.
Interestingly, there's been a few siblings that have been through the WAPA
mm-hmm.
process.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps Nathan and then you were one of the first, perhaps.
Yeah, I think.
Was it daunting going and training where Nathan had been? Because you went through at the same time.
No, he graduated, I want to say 98. 98.
I was 96 and he was in first year and I was third.
Yeah, 98 and I was there 2001. So I missed any students being there at the same time.
Oh, right.
It was only really the teachers. But no, I was the complete opposite. I was sort of like, hey guys, so I'm Nathan Carter's sister. Jenny Lind, who was the head of dance at the time, she loved Nath because he was a great dancer.
Yeah.
He tapped beautifully. And so we had sort of different skill sets in the sense that I just couldn't dance. He was a dancer. I couldn't dance. But the fact that Jenny loved him sort of gave, it did not give me a free pass, but there was sort of this whole thing of like, oh, well, I don't dance like Nath. And that was sort of, okay, that was a bit more acceptable. But I embraced what I wasn't good at. I was very, I think going...
Well, it's important to know that, know what your skill set is.
Absolutely. Because I went when I was a bit older, so I was 23. So by that point, I've moved out of home. I've worked full-time in like a performance sort of environment, not a show, but I used to work at Fox Studios when it was the back lot, and I used to host shows. So I'd sort of had a little bit of like full-time performance experience, you know, and just a bit of life experience under my belt. And so then going to Whopper, I was really honest with myself and can sort of say, I'm really good at X, Y, Z, but ABC, you can maybe forget about it. So when it came to casting and things like that in shows, I wouldn't really disagree with them. I'd be like, oh yeah, I'm not going to play that role. That's so not me. And I do think that that's a very healthy perspective to have. And so when you do enter the professional world, it's not to cut off anything that is new. I don't want to sort of say, oh, well, I only do this and so therefore I can't do anything else. Like, you don't want it to be a limiting thing. But at the same time, I think it really helps to have a healthy perspective around what you will probably be employed to do, the type of character you would probably be seen as, how you're employable. So when those shows come around, you go, great, okay, I feel confident, I feel comfortable going for this. You know, for me, West Side Story comes out, it's like, oh, well, you can forget about it.
Yeah.
Don't dance, you know, not Hispanic. I mean,
you can play Shrank.
I'm really good, actually. You know, so it's having that realistic, having that knowledge about yourself and just knowing, I guess, what your product is very helpful.
Drama school is often the first time that young people are dealing with emotions outside or experiences outside their own lived experience. And, and that can be quite confronting and quite daunting. I saw you give a beautiful performance in Wild Party.
Did you? Oh, I didn't know that.
I was in Perth at the time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it was a lovely production. But, you know, you're playing the role of Queenie, who experiences domestic violence with her partner.
Yeah.
A tough role, especially for a 23, 24-year-old or however you were. And I think that, you know, in those drama skills, there's certainly a place for some sort of counselling or teaching students how to de-role after a performance. What was your experience of playing Queenie, and was that confronting?
I loved playing that role. I mean, I look back on that as honestly the highlight of that 3 years. I got very, very lucky with that role because I think it was, you know, obviously it's a role that is vocally wonderful, very emotionally charged. So, you know, even for students who were sort of more acting based, it was a great, you know, challenge. So I got super lucky with that one. I loved playing that role. And it's funny because I look back now and I can see, I think, certain things that maybe were lacking at that point around it, all the things that you were talking about, sort of counselling and de-rolling. And this is absolutely nothing about Whopper or the teachers or anything. No. I just think the culture around it has changed.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so it's interesting. Last year, I was in Perth and I met up with Craig Dalton, who's now the head of music theatre at Whopper. And because I just wanted to talk to him about mental health, and it's sort of like, as an alumni, you know, and someone who obviously is very heavily into sort of mental health for the arts now, what do you have in place for students? I'd love to hear about it. And I was so thrilled to hear they have so much in place for those students now. There is a lot of communication, a lot of support, a lot of resources about their needs, issues they might have as a student, but also as a performer. So, you know, I think times have changed in the culture, in the industry in general, around diversity and inclusivity within casting, whether that sort of you know, people who identify as non-binary, like how do those people see themselves being cast in shows? And so students that identify as non-binary would have the conversations with the decision makers about casting. Like, how do you feel being cast? Like, what would make you feel comfortable being cast? You know, how do we work with that? And you know, everything that Craig was telling me, it's sort of like, whoa, we would never, none of this existed back in the day. So
in the Wild West.
What's that?
The Wild West.
It sort of was. And again, you know, this is nothing about
no,
Whopper at the time. It just, the adage of the show must go on. And
we're talking 20, 25 years.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking a really long time now. Thank you for reminding me yet again. It has been a couple of decades. But, you know, so when it came to Queenie, there was no, we had zero conversations around anything that I was required to do or anyone else was required to do. As you said, there were a few scenes in that that were very confronting. So there was, you know, trigger warning. There was a rape scene, and there was a scene where I had to physically fondle other people and literally do it. And I remember rehearsing it. It was just like, just go and do it. Like, so there was no conversation of like, what do you feel comfortable with? What do you, you know, how do we navigate this? And obviously now they've got intimacy coordinators, and that's definitely being addressed in professional landscape, but also at Whopper and institutions, sure, which is fantastic. Yes, absolutely. So it's good to hear that things have changed. But yeah, that experience, there was sort of no conversation. It was sort of like, okay, so we're rehearsing it, so and action and do it, you know. And that was just what it was. Yeah.
You established a very successful career post Whopper. You know, shows like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did you think, I need to diversify here and maybe try something else? And indeed you did. You went off and trained to be a counsellor.
Yeah. To be honest, age. I mean, I do think that whatever age and whatever, you know, whatever part of your career you're in, I do think it's a really good idea to think about other skills. And this is not to set up anyone for disappointment or anything. It's more, I know for me, I'll only speak about my experience. When I graduated, I did put all my eggs in one basket a little bit. It's sort of like, I do musicals, the end. This is all I do. And that was great for quite a time, but there are only so many musicals that come around every year. So, you know, for me, I hadn't thought through, well, what happens if I miss out on all those big shows, all three of them, you know, at the time there weren't that many coming out. What do I do for that 12 months until the next big show comes out? So I hadn't really prepared myself for like, what else do I have? What other skills do I have? Or what's something else that can give me joy in something that isn't performing? And that did bite me on the bum a couple of times of when I had a low period of employment. It was also a low period just in life of like, oh, I'm not doing the thing that makes me feel whole. So when I sort of hit about 40, late 30s, 40, I mean, I'd had enough experience in the professional industry that I was starting to notice that support within the workplace especially was sort of missing, and was seeing certain colleagues and friends in shows really have a tough time with whatever they were experiencing, and there was sort of nothing there to help those people. A lot of shows have really wonderful company managers, and a lot of the company managers I've worked for are the most warmest, approachable, kindest, empathic people. Unfortunately, not all of them are. And so if someone was struggling with something, that would usually be the person that you go and seek out and have those conversations with. And sometimes company managers were really great at those conversations. They'd bring you into their office, shut the door. You'd try and have a confidential chat about something. But at the same time, there's that awareness that they work for the producer. And so it's sort of how confidential is confidential. And also in their defense, in the company manager's defense, it's sort of not their, it's not part of their job description, you know, to take on dealing through interpersonal issues or someone in crisis or, you know. And so I was sort of starting to notice like, oh, I feel like there's a bit of a gap here. And then that sort of coincided with getting close to 40. And it's like, oh, there's also a gap in roles for 40-year-old women here. And after a year or two of very quiet on the career front, it was sort of like, this just doing musicals thing is probably not working for me anymore. What other skills are there? And because it was something I was passionate about for a long time, it got to a point of like, I think I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to go back to uni. I'm so passionate about this by this point. I feel like change needs to happen. And so went back to uni, and at that point I also had to decide that I had to stop my career in music theatre and theatre or commercials or anything that was sort of like a public public medium, or working with potential clients. You know, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be a counsellor for 6 months until the next big show comes out, and then I'll go and join that cast, because it's sort of like, oh, there's a person I had as a client 6 months ago, or I'm going to try and get clients in a year's time when the show is over and they saw me in a show. Like, it's too blurry. It's unethical.
Yeah.
And so I also had to make this decision of like, am I ready to put a full stop on that part of my career? And by that point I was, I felt like I'd accomplished a lot. I also have kids, which, you know, you throw them in the mix, that sort of complicates things even more. So touring was challenging, you know, having that freedom to just be like, I'm going to Melbourne for 6 months to do a show. Mm. That wasn't really my reality anymore. Mm. So it was easy to make that decision of like, I think it's time to go off in a different direction and something I'm really, really passionate about. And so that's what I did.
And you started a company called Centred Stage.
Yes. So I opened a private practice back in 2022, once I'd finished the counselling qualification and also a coaching qualification as well, which isn't life coaching, because that's what everyone sort of thinks of. It's got a foot in the camp with counselling, but it's more sort of looking at the future. So counselling is sort of like how the past is affecting your present. And then coaching is more sort of like what we can do in the present to help in the future, sort of thing. And they can sort of straddle each other a little bit. So yeah, once those two qualifications were done, it was a case of opening a private practice to just be available for clients. I mean, the catch is that the people that need a service like this usually can't afford it.
Yes.
It is, and it is sort of that catch 22 of, A lot of the time when clients are needing a service like this, they're probably unemployed or have been for a time and then starting to really doubt their abilities, maybe starting to get a bit of anxiety around auditions because the pressure is sort of increasing on, I need to get this job because it's been 9 months since I had a job and I didn't get that one. Okay, so the next one, I really, really have to get that job, and that anxiety of not working can sort of build up. And I've experienced that before. It can snowball for you of just sort of like, shit, I really need to get the next one, and then that doesn't happen. And
well, it's a life of the unknown, isn't it?
Oh,
and that's really challenging. Even if you get a show, there's no guarantee that it will run the length of time that you're hoping it will.
And
run.
It also doesn't guarantee that you're going to feel happy and satisfied as well. You know, I'd always observed three different areas that sort of need attention in the industry with mental health. So private practice, individual clients needing a session, talk through whatever's happening for them. It's education, so back at Whopper. So luckily these institutions now are addressing that. How do we equip students with the tools to work with such a difficult industry? So when they start getting rejected, well, not rejected, but, you know, if they have a spate of unsuccessful auditions, what do they do? You know, mentally, where does that leave them? Also, you've gone from an environment where you're a family to you're now, it's just you, you know, everyone graduates, you do showcase, and then it's like, bye, you know, thanks the last 3 years. And then hopefully you've got an agent that can help guide you. But if you don't, it's sort of like, what happens now? And then the last area, obviously, is the workplace, because, you know, we've all done shows that for whatever reason we had a tough time on, whether it was interpersonal relationships, whether it was the pressure of the actual show, maybe it's a really challenging role and you're having difficulty leaving that role in the work, you know, back in the theatre, and you go home and you're carrying it with you. Or, you know, one thing that they don't talk about a lot in drama school, I don't think, is the Groundhog Day nature of long running shows. So, you know, I know back in my time, that was everyone's assumed definition of success was getting into a quote unquote big show. I'm going to do a big show that goes for like 2 years and is a monster. But then what happens after opening night when you're doing 8 shows a week, every week? You might also have cover calls during the day. like your whole life is committed to that show, and there's a Groundhog Day nature of it.
Oh, yes, yes. I've spoken to performers who talk about, you know, what other occupation, you know that at 10 past nine every night you're going to be passing that person.
That's what I was saying.
As they come off stage. and then you're going to go over and you're going to pick up that glass.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Absolutely. Because everyone thinks about, oh, the show's the same. And it's like, no, pretty much from the moment you walk in the building, it's going to be the same. Your dress is going to come in with your underwear. Here it is. You're going to have a chat. They're going to put it down. You're going to put on the same face and makeup sitting next to the same people. And as you say, it's the traffic. It's your plot backstage. Oh, I walk past the props guy at that point. We share that little joke about something.
Yeah.
I wrote a blog about how to deal with the groundhog nature of a show because no one talks about it until you're sort of 6 months in and you're like, why am I losing my connection with the show? Why am I, maybe my mind is wandering when I'm on stage and I'm coming off stage and I can't remember what I just did and I'm starting to feel overwhelmed, or I'm just bored. And the thing is, a lot of the time you can't go and talk to your performer mates or your crewmates because they might not be working, so they're off having the problems of being unemployed and you're on the big hit show going, I'm sort of hating it, you know, it's and no one talks about it. No one talks about it at all. So there's all the workplace stuff as well.
I spoke to Andy Carl a couple of episodes ago, who's starring in Groundhog Day in Melbourne at the moment. He talked about having Groundhog Day Deluxe.
Oh, you know, my God.
Because, you know, the musical about Groundhog Day, where you are constantly on repeat.
Oh,
and you're repeating that eight times a week. And this is the fourth company with which he's done the show. So,
oh, my God.
Imagine
what does he do? Did he talk about sort of how he approaches that?
Well, I mean, he's a professional and deals with it as people are sort of forced to do,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, yeah,
but yeah.
It's tough. I mean, you know, around that, I think all you can really do is make sure your daytimes are really stimulating. You make sure that there are other hobbies, passions that you're sort of tapping into during the day, but also try and change up that routine. It's like come out of your dressing room and watch part of the show you haven't really connected with, or you know, change it up.
Well, the other fascinating condition, of course, is stage fright. How a performer can be doing the same show for a long time and then suddenly it just I can't do this.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that comes from that Groundhog Day, because it's such a muscle memory. You're on such autopilot by that point because of just finding that groove and just gently sinking into it. There are different things you can do on stage to try and get your mind back on it. I mean, I remember during Priscilla, we did Priscilla for nearly 2.5 years. That's the longest running show I ever did. We did, I don't remember how many shows, like 800 and something. And I missed a handful because of sickness. And I sang I Will Survive, which ended the first act. And we'd be standing on the bus and I just wouldn't even need to think about the lyrics anymore. And I'd have these moments. And honestly, this is not suicidal ideation or anything like that. But I'd be like, what if I just jumped off the bus right now? Like, what would what could I do right now to just do something sort of chaotic, just to change, just to have something different happen?
Craving change.
Yeah, yeah. And so it wasn't about me jumping off a very tall bus. It was more about sort of just almost feeling tempted to just do something really unexpected because my body was aching for something different, you know. So it's about trying to get the mind back in that moment of like, oh, there's like a 1500 people here who might want you to really focus on what you're doing right now. You know, and so there's definitely techniques that you can sort of just try and get your head back in the game a little bit.
We've been talking a lot about performers, but of course, musicians in the pit and crew
and
workers
absolutely
experience similar things.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's very similar for them. It's sort of like, what can you do differently within that 4 or 5 hours that you're in the building? What can you do? Because I think we do have room to find new things. I think we just fall into the, it's in that scene. They're in that scene. I can hear it on the tannoy. This is the point that I get up and I walk out and I go and do something, you know, I go back to stage. Like, go back 5 minutes earlier. Or, you know, try and just do something to try and change it up within those very tight restrictions.
Yeah. Touring can seem to be quite glamorous. You're
traveling so glamorous.
All around the nation or all around the world and with the show. But effectively, 24/7, that employment is yeah. is your life.
Yeah.
Because after the show finishes, you're still probably mixing with people from the show.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So that's another thing to deal with, isn't it?
Yeah, touring is a hard one, especially because, you know, for me personally, I think a lot of the issues with touring are really around, it's not so much what's happening in the theatre, it's sort of everything outside the theatre. So you are probably in a service department that is very... probably very beige, with the same artwork on the walls and the same beige lounges, and you know, you've got the same apartment that everyone else has.
Beige.
Beige. I don't know why they like to make everything so plain in these places. But you know, it's about trying to create a home away from home. It's trying to sort of create a space that you can come back to and go, this is my place with my things. You know, as much as you can have pictures on the walls and things like that. You know, how do you bring in your life into that space so you can come home and feel like, okay, I'm not at work anymore. I'm in my current home, whether it's photos, whether it's your embedding, whether it's, you know, whether you do put pictures on the walls, your favorite bowl, you know, whatever it might be, to just create a space that is familiar and that feels like you're at home, you know. Also... really retaining the relationships you have at home, because we all fall into that situation of like, this is my 50 person family, this company of whatever show, and you know, that can lead to its own issues, I think, when the intensity of that family is sort of all you have in that moment. So it is about sort of keeping alive those relationships that are sort of back home, whether it's Zoom, whether it's regular phone calls, whether it's trips of them coming over to see you, just trying to have that life again outside the building that's just not all about that building all the time. Mm-hmm. It's hard. Well, it can be fun though. It can be fun. It's, you know, you're also in a new city, a chance to explore, a chance to have an experience in a different city, a different part of the country, essentially for free. You know, you're sort of, you've got a day that you can go to Rottnest, or you can go and explore, you can go to the Adelaide Hills and see what's happening up there, and you know, wherever you may be. So it's about using that downtime as something for you.
In recent years there's been a growth in intimacy coordinators mm-hmm. on set, on working with productions, etc. Have we seen some sort of growth with performing arts counsellors, coaches, or,
yeah.
or are you one of a very few?
Yes and no. The talk of counselling and mental health in the arts came, I would say, for me, when I first became aware of it, it would have been around sort of 2014, 2015. There were a couple of concerts that that were put on called Out From Under, and it was about talking about mental health in the arts. And these were great nights where people would sort of get up and perform, but then also have sort of experts coming in and talking about it. And since then, I do feel like that has started not only the conversation, but there are groups that have now formed and companies that have now formed that are specifically about performing arts mental health support. So there's Support Act, which is more of the music scene, but it does sort of also fall into just live performance in general. There's the Arts Wellbeing Collective in Melbourne that work out of the Arts Centre. They have a free hotline, which is, I guess, sort of similar to Lifeline, but it's for people who work in the arts. And so it's like a 24/7 hotline that you can call up and speak to somebody. There's also the MEAA also now has a wellness committee, which I'm one of the co-chairs on. So it's about sort of creating resources for people to access about sort of mental health support. And then there are sort of there's also the Hey Mate Project in Brisbane, which are a non-for-profit, and they are sort of mental health services for the arts. And producers have started realizing that people need this and are wanting this, and producers have brought in a couple of measures which are good. I wouldn't say we're quite there yet, but it's a really, really good start. One of them is that they're telling people to call the Arts Wellbeing Collective Hotline, which is in conjunction with Support Act. They form that together. And then they also have allowed company members to access an EAP, which is an employment EAP, Employment Assistance. Ah, I can't even remember what it stands for. Employee Assistance Program. Gosh.
We've got one of those at school.
Yes. So an EAP, EAPs exist in corporations all around. This is not art specific. And it's basically access to free counselling. My only, and I think that is awesome. My only concern around that and the feedback that I'm getting from people who have accessed it is that those therapists are muggles. They're muggle therapists. So they're not arts specific therapists. So what's happening is clients are accessing this service and then spending a long time trying to explain context, relationships. Well,
that's the thing. How often have we come up against that? You know, people who just don't understand how the arts industry works.
Yes.
I mean, I'm thinking of when you have to go on the dole.
Yeah.
You go down and you talk to
an officer. And they go, have you applied for your 10 jobs this fortnight? It's like, well, I mean...
No, that's not a job you need. That's a job you want.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't
well,
that your
no,
hobby?
I'm sorry. It's my employment. No.
Yeah, so what's happening is these clients are seeking out the service, which is excellent. But the help they're getting, I'm sure not all the time, but a lot of what I've heard have been just a lot of time spent trying to explain just context. So, you know, for someone who hasn't worked in the arts or who hasn't done a show, say you have an actor go and seek a counselor or a psychologist and they start talking about issues they're having with company management and then they maybe start talking about issues they're having with stage management. Now, if you've never worked in the arts before, like, what's the difference between a company manager and a stage manager? Like, we know that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's not just so much the job descriptions are different. The type of relationship an actor will have with both of those departments are very different. The hierarchy is sort of slightly different because their jobs are different. And there's nuances in those relationships that I feel muggle therapists maybe just don't really understand. But also, you know, I've
now,
heard...
Now, when you say muggle, of course, you're talking about the garden variety.
Yes. Traditional, I should say traditional therapists who don't have that experience. I mean, I heard one experience. I mean, I laugh, but it's full on. That a client was talking to an EAP about how they had to spend their day off, their Monday, doing publicity. Now, we've all had to do that. Mm. In Priscilla, that's pretty much when all the publicity was and the divas would get dragged out of the cupboard and we would do a lot of publicity on Mondays. We even flew to New Zealand from Sydney to do one day of publicity in New Zealand and then to fly back to then go back to the Tuesday night show. I mean, and I understand why they do that. It's your only day off. So this client was talking to this therapist about the stress and the pressure around that and not having a day off. And the therapist thought it sounded really glamorous. And it's like, oh, no. It's okay. Yes, it probably does sound really like you're flying off to do something. But this person is tired. This person is stressed. This person is feeling a pressure. They don't have a day off to unwind, to decompress, to step away from the show. And to have a therapist come back with that response, I mean, I'm sure they meant well.
Yeah.
But it would be very disheartening if I was a client and that was their response. I would feel they don't get it.
Yeah.
They don't really understand. So in answer to your question, yes, producers are starting to realize that more is needed, like intimacy coordinators. I think with counseling, though, we're not quite there yet. I think what they've got in place is a great start, but it's not quite... We're not quite finished yet.
Yeah, well, Rome wasn't built in a day.
No, exactly.
It is the start of a very important journey.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and especially, you know, a lot of people took note, of course, during COVID, where a lot of anxieties flared up for people. And
I mean, it was an interesting thing to observe online. You know, obviously, we're all in lockdown, and that's the only way people are really communicating with each other through Facebook and, you know, posts that they were posting. And, you know, I think it was very confronting for a lot of people because it was this forced situation of what else do I do? If I don't have access to that thing, in this sense, because of lockdown, what else do I do? Like, what other skills do I have? What are the other things that I can... And that's very confronting, especially when there was no end date at that point of like, how long is this going to go on for? I think it brought up that question for a lot of people. It's like if
and
the
a lot
arts,
of people left the industry too, didn't they?
They left the industry, they retrained in other things, and I think that was really sad to see a lot of people go. I mean, we're talking some really top echelon people were like, I'm out. But, you know, getting back to what I was saying earlier in the podcast, it's like I think we all need to be able to openly ask ourselves that question. Because even the people who are leads that we look at and emulate as being like the top people, they're not in employment 12 months of the year, every year for the rest of their lives. They will have downtime as well. So it's a question that everyone could ask themselves just to prepare themselves for, like, okay, what brings me joy? What fills me up and keeps me satisfied? What makes me feel valuable and skilled and talented? What makes me happy that isn't this thing? And that's not to say that you're rejecting that thing, but I feel like sometimes in the arts, we feel we don't have a lot of control over things. And so it is sort of, for me anyway, it's like, I'm just going to keep floating down the stream till I find out the next show that's going to come on. And I think I gave away a lot of power in that. And I had a lot more control at that time than I thought I did. Whether it was exploring film and television or whether it was exploring just recording stuff with a microphone in my own house or putting on my own show, you know. I know everyone says, oh, just put on your own show, and it's a bit of a cliche thing, but there's some truth in it. It's like, take some power back. You've got 6 months off. Create, you know, do something that's going to fill you up, that's not waiting for the phone to ring. Again, speaking from my own experience, you know, but that's the mistake I made for a really long time. And I feel it's a pertinent question to ask yourself when you work in the arts. It's like, what else, what other thing do I have that I go, yes, it gives me that satisfaction.
Yeah, it is about creating that personal expression. And that can be, you know, again, I spoke to performers, and that other thing is painting or gardening or cooking.
Yep.
There are so many ways that you can harness and focus that.
And I think because performing or whatever area of the arts that you work in, I mean, I always speak about performers, but obviously this would go for a lot of people in different areas. You know, it's something we've probably identified with as a child. So it's something we've done our whole life. And so we have developed this relationship with it, that it's like, that's what I do. If I meet a new person and they say, oh, who are you? Like, what do you do? It's literally the first thing out of my mouth. It's probably out of my mouth before I say I'm a parent. Mm. Oh, and then I'm a mother of two. It's like, so I'm a singer, you know? And I think that we've put so much time and energy into this one thing. It's sort of like, again, for me to say that I do something else would be like, oh, it lessens the performing or it lessens the singing. So I don't want to let anything else in because I just want it to be about that. Especially when you go to drama school and you live it and you breathe it and it becomes your whole life. That's valuable, but it's also very dangerous as well. So I think it's about finding that balance with other things.
It's a fascinating and important subject. I mean, you should start your own podcast.
Look, it's on the cards. It is on the cards. Yes, I mean, as I'm sure you've sort of gathered, I can talk underwater about this particular topic.
But
I'm very passionate
about it.
There's
much to learn.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah. Sophie Carter, it's been lovely meeting you.
Thank you.
I've known your brother Nathan for a long time.
Us Carters, there's always a couple of us floating around.
I've completed the set now.
Yeah. We're like Happy Meal toys.
Yeah. Thanks, Sophie.
Lovely to meet you. Thanks.
A salient conversation not only for arts workers, but all of us who work in a variety of industries. Sophie Carter offers performing arts counselling and coaching to arts workers, whether commencing a career or established in the arts. More information at centeredstage.com. We certainly hope this conversation has been of assistance to a listener. Thanks for joining us in this episode, and thanks to my guest, Sophie Carter. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.